This is Law and Disorder.
On Law and Disorder today, we'll be talking about the Graham Amendment and the McCain Amendment.
Taking away habeas that's only been a right in the world for 900 years. How to reverse 900 years of legal and civil rights in a day.
We'll learn about the case in Syracuse, New York, of a prominent Iraqi-American doctor who was sentenced to 22 years in prison for violating Iraqi sanctions through his charity Help the Needy.
He went to Iraq to help Iraq when sanctions enforced by the United States caused the death by starvation and malnutrition of 600,000 children.
We'll hear about men and women formerly detained at Orleans Parish Prison, and we'll hear the disturbing details of what they went through.
If you want to talk or hear about man's inhumanity to man, think about the New Orleans Parish Prison. Chained, locked into cells while the water is rising around you. It's actually an Egyptian torture technique. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, ACLU's Arab Muslim South Asian advocate.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Over the last few weeks, the Senate has been debating a number of important amendments that really go to the heart of the question about detentions, torture, as well as the Iraq War. It's been amazing to watch it, actually. It looks like a bunch of Roman senators, except they're not wearing togas in the imperial regime. I mean, that's really what it looks like. Normally, we don't have a lot to do with what's going on in Congress. We think the way to win these battles is not in Congress. But it's been an interesting week as to the unraveling of this administration, as well as their efforts to try and put Humpty Dumpty back together again. We have three pieces of legislation, two that we really want to discuss among us, and then we're going to have a special guest, Gary Isaac, who's one of the lawyers I work with on the Guantanamo cases. First of all, you all probably know about the McCain Amendment. That was passed 90-9 in the Senate as an amendment to the Senate Department of Defense Authorization Bill. 90-9, it prohibited cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment against non-citizens outside the United States. Now, that's always been prohibited, but after some of the memos that came out of the administration, particularly Gonzalez's memo, the man who was president's counsel and is now head of the Justice Department, he said that that wasn't prohibited. So now McCain, who himself alleges that he was tortured in Vietnam, has passed an amendment 90-9 prohibiting it all over the world. The president has said, one, I'll either veto the bill, or two, the CIA has to be exempted. So we're going to discuss the McCain Amendment today. The second amendment happened over the last couple of weeks. And for me personally, it's particularly outrageous because it affects all of the cases we've brought on behalf of the Guantanamo detainees. The initial cut at it was passed by Senator Graham, called the Graham Amendment, that would have wiped out habeas corpus, the right to have your detention tested, for people, non-citizens, detained at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Wiped it out altogether. Over the last week, there's been a huge lobbying effort to get that amendment taken out or at least modified. A lot of the modifications were put in, but the amendment still really wipes out the fundamental right to habeas corpus that people in this world have really had since 1215, the year of the Magna Carta. Now, there's obviously a relationship between McCain and the Graham Amendment, or what's called the Graham-Levin Amendment. One of them is, even if you prohibit cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, a lower form of torture, under McCain, how are you going to find out about it if you can't go to Guantanamo and visit your clients and bring habeas corpus petitions? So there's that relationship. There's really the sellout of a lot of the Democrats on the McCain Amendment. And the third one is, of course, the Iraq War Amendment, where you got senators standing up and saying, we were misled into this war. We think we have to have reporting requirements. We think some of them said we have to have a date certain for pulling out. In the end, of course, the Republicans dominated and controlled, and they simply got some reporting requirements in, which, while it's a step forward, it's a very small step. I mean, some of us on this program have lived through reporting requirements throughout the Central American wars and everywhere else. So that's our topic for the next few minutes. Again, we're joined by our wonderful hosts here, Michael, Dahlia, and Heidi. And this is Michael Ratner.
McCain's amendment should be supported. Any decent person would be against torture or even lesser forms of torture. But McCain is no hero of mine, Michael. You remember that excellent article that Coburn had in his newsletter a couple years ago documenting McCain's role as a carpet bomber when he flew over Vietnam before he was captured and allegedly tortured?
The times are making some strange bedfellows, Michael.
Yeah, really?
As the U.S. moves farther and farther to the right, you're getting guys out there who either see a chance to punch Bush when he wants to run for president himself, like McCain, or who might really care about the issue.
Well, what's the relationship between the Graham Amendment and the McCain Amendment?
What do you guys think?
I think it's a little bit more than just you won't be able to find out if the U.S. government is really torturing. I mean, people look at what's been happening to detainees at the hands of the U.S. government around the world, and they think that this is already illegal. I think this is just pretty much for show.
The McCain Amendment is pretty much for show.
I mean, he may mean it, but I think a lot of the senators really do feel that we will be able to still do whatever we want when we have detainees in secret locations, be it in Poland, Guantanamo, or even here in the U.S.
I think that's a good point. I mean, obviously, the CIA is going to, we're not going to be able to know what they do in these secret detention facilities that are all over the world. So McCain Amendment, Schmain Amendment, as long as people are essentially disappeared and under the thumb of government officials, CIA and others, they're going to be able to be tortured.
Olympia Snow, where is she from? She's the Republican senator.
Maine.
From Maine,
my favorite
yeah.
state.
And you know what? Her spokesperson had the nerve to say, describing her boss's attitude, describing Olympia Snow's attitude. She said, do we need all those lawyers going down there to hear their complaints, meaning Guantanamo? It seems a little extreme to her. We're talking about enemy combatants. And I think that's really at the heart of a lot of feelings in Congress, that these are people who don't deserve rights that we have already decided should be accorded to every human being.
You think their ethnicity, their religion, has anything to do with it, Dahlia?
Yeah. How do you distinguish? Why now are they overthrowing an 800-year-old law, the Magna Carta? You know, why now are they public proclaiming that they're for torture? You know, that we know that they've tortured people since the CIA started developing these techniques 50 years ago. Al McCoy has documented that. But why now do you folks think that they're openly talking about the ability to torture people, to keep people locked up and throw away the key forever, and they're saying that should be legal now? Why is it happening now? Why didn't it happen 15 years ago?
What's going on? They're afraid of what they don't know, and they're ignorant to a certain extent, and so they lash out. I mean, we suspended habeas corpus during the Japanese internments.
We actually didn't.
We didn't?
No, that was said on the floor of the Congress. The center, of course, then misquoted it in a press release, and then another National Lawyers Guild lawyer wrote an article, so that's how it got in there. The last time habeas was suspended was during the Civil War, when Congress did it, after Lincoln tried himself, and then Congress didn't. During the Japanese cases, those were really a year later, but they were basically upheld by the Supreme Court, and habeas, they had a right to file habeas, they just never got anywhere with it. So it was really over 130 years ago. Now, when Michael asks why now, another why now that's interesting, whether you look at the Patriot Act or the suspension of habeas, which we're talking about, you know, it may be that as the country's getting weaker as a dominant power, that it begins to tighten up its both its internal dissent procedures as well as its procedures for dealing with dissidents.
Yeah.
So I think it actually could be looked at as a sign of weakness in the country. And the Patriot Act, of course, fits that even better, maybe.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Because you take away their overwhelming military power, take that away from the people that run this country, and what do you got left? You got a country that's uneducated, that's culturally ignorant, that's unhealthy. You got a country that can't even stop a flood in New Orleans. You know, this is not the kind of first world country that it used to be or that it says it is. And anybody that travels, say, go to Europe, and you look around there and you realize that the America is a lot different than a lot of other parts of the so-called developed world.
And sadly, I think people now in this country don't really feel that their voice counts, that they have any input to government, that they have any control or say. And it results in an apathy that...
Well, I think it's because there's such a huge disconnect between what the public thinks is decent and honorable and the way we should be living our lives and what they're voting for. I mean, let's take a look specifically at what happened in Congress over the last couple of weeks. You had, for the Graham Amendment, you had originally the amendment voted 84 to 14, 84 to 14, overwhelmingly passed, that would have cut off all court access for individuals detained, basically saying you don't ever get to see an attorney, we can hold you as long as we like, and you don't get to come and have a day in court to hear the charges against you, if there are some, and to offer up a defense. And that was voted for overwhelmingly. Now, the partial victory that people are claiming is that the Senate then amended that to say, well, if you've been held in Guantanamo for 10 years or more, you can then come to court. Or if you've been tried by a military tribunal and they found you to be an enemy combatant, you can then take it to a court. You can appeal it in a court. These are incredibly limited rights.
No, we can't talk about a victory, really. We can talk about, you know, some of the Democrats voted for the ultimate bill, I think, just on the grounds that it's the best they were going to do.
Yeah.
But really, it really wipes out a fundamental right. Now, one of our arguments, which we'll have to see how it goes, is that it's only prospective, meaning it only applies to future people, which isn't great either. But
that's
at least,
a cold comfort.
Right, but it may save the few hundred people that we have actually filed cases for. And Senator Levin, who was co-sponsor of the modified bill, the man from Michigan, put on the legislative record that that's what he said. Now, the bill, as I said, has been passed by the Senate. It next goes to the conference. The House has not passed anything like this, and we'll have to see what happens in conference in the next 3 to 4 weeks. And the question is, can we beat it back in there? But really, this, if you want to talk about something that's a paving block to the police state, it's suspending or tampering with the writ of habeas corpus. Because the fundamental protection is the president can't pick you up by your neck, toss you in jail, and throw the key away. And that's what this says they can do.
And this shows there's no respect for the Supreme Court decision, the June 2004 Supreme Court decision, saying that they can't do this.
Right. The center case, the case that won the right of habeas for people at Guantanamo, interpreted the statute so we had the right. This was an attempt and is an attempt and is trying to nullify the center's victory in 2004. That's really what it's about.
And Rasul, the Supreme Court held, I just want to read the sentence, that consistent with the historic purpose of the writ, this court has recognized the federal court's power to review applications for habeas relief in a wide variety of cases involving executive detention in wartime as well as in times of peace.
Yeah.
One last, before we go to our guest, our guest is going to be Gary Isaac, who's from a law firm in Chicago, who's one of the main coordinating people, substantive people we've been using on Guantanamo. Before we turn to Gary, I want to say one word that was particularly offensive to me. On the floor of the Senate, in debating this bill, Senator Graham did a series of lies, 17 different lies. We can go to the center's website, which is ccr-ny.org, and get those 17 lies. One of the lies that we didn't put up there was the quote he used from me that I made to Mother Jones. There was a quote, he said, and Michael Ratner, one of the lawyers representing Guantanamo detainees, said the more lawyers we get down there, we're going to end the government's interrogation of people in Guantanamo. So everybody said, what? Michael wants to, you know, they want, that's what the Guantanamo lawyers are all about. But the whole quote actually is, end the government's interrogation and torture camps at Guantanamo. And he left out the word torture. So trying to, not that interrogation camps are legal, because they're not.
Before we go to Gary, there's one more quote that I just found incredibly angering among the many from Graham. He said, For 200 years, ladies and gentlemen, in the law of armed conflict, no nation has given an enemy combatant, a terrorist, an Al-Qaeda member, the ability to go into every federal court in this United States and sue the people that are fighting the war for us. Beyond being nonsensical, of course no nation would have the right to accord people the ability to go into U.S. courts. That's a right that only the U.S. government can and should give.
And the issue here, of course, is are these people Al-Qaeda? Are
exactly.
they terrorists?
There's
we want
no...
trials. That's all the people are saying. They're not even saying free us immediately. They're saying free us or give us trials.
We'd
Let's
like
go
to
Gary.
Welcome Gary Isaacs.
Gary? Gary Isaac, as I said, is a lawyer in Chicago who's one of our chief lawyers working on the Guantanamo detentions and particularly right now on the legislative issue. And Gary, you're here with our three other hosts, Michael Smith.
Hi, Gary.
Dahya Hashad from the ACLU.
Hi.
Hi.
And Heidi Boghossian from the National Lawyers Guild.
Welcome, Gary.
Thank you very much.
So, Gary, we've had some discussion of the Graham-Levin Amendment, but why don't you give us your take on some of how it got there, and let's start off first, how bad is it?
Well, it's hard to say exactly how bad it is. Certainly, any effort to tinker with habeas, particularly one that's done so hastily and without any kind of proper hearings, you know, is a bad thing. I mean, this was clearly done hastily, kind of on the back of a napkin, so to speak, at the last minute. We learned about it, I think it was Tuesday of the week of last week, so 10 days ago. We learned about it by reading in the Washington Post that Senator Graham intended to offer a rider to the Senate authorization bill that would strip the courts of habeas jurisdiction in these cases, and it's been a big fight ever since. But you know what exactly the legislation would mean? It's hard to say for sure. We're still studying it, and it's kind of a jerry-rigged bill, and so it's hard to see how all the pieces would work together.
Right. I know one of our arguments, as I said earlier when I introduced the segment, I said is that it's prospective and may not apply to our current Guantanamo. I think it's a good argument it doesn't apply to our current Guantanamo detainees.
Well, Senator Levin has stated publicly that it is his intent, and he's one of the co-sponsors of this amendment as it was enacted, that it was his intent, and he believes Senator Graham shares that intent, that it would not apply to strip the courts of jurisdiction in the pending cases. But it's hard to say how this will play out in the legislative process as it unfolds, because it's now in conference committee or will be, and obviously it's hard to predict how courts would interpret the statute, however, if the language gets in, whatever the language ultimately is.
Well, Gary, what do you say to our critics who say, well, what do you want to give these guys rights for? They just as soon blow up a building with our mothers and sisters in it than look at us, and you guys are bending over backwards to give them rights. What do you say to that argument?
What I say to that is, I think, and I tell people this all the time, I am articulating what is, I would say, is the conservative view. The conservative view, as I always understood it growing up, was that the king, the president, the executive should not be able to lock up anyone on his own say-so without having that reviewed in court. And so, sure, if people are committing terrorist acts, they ought to be held. And, I don't want people that are committing terrorist acts out there either, but we don't really know whether most of these people have done anything bad. And in fact, the government's own spokespeople have said that most of the people who are at Guantanamo were, picked up in the fog of war. It appears they were picked up by the Northern Alliance, who were paid $5,000 apiece by the U.S. government, and so they just picked up anyone they could find and essentially sold them for bounty to the U.S. Forces in Afghanistan. And so what we really don't know is which, if any, of these are actually terrorists, and the government's own people have said most of them clearly are not. They were running, not fighting. And so what we want to do is get these people a day in court. Nothing more American than giving people a day in court and a chance to face accusations and defend themselves, and let the courts decide whether people are or not enemy combatants and whether they should properly be held.
Well, we're changing the definition of what's American these days.
Gary, do you have any sense of really what prompted this piece of legislation from Graham? I mean, here we were. I mean, you've been working on Guantanamo with all of us together for a number of years now. That Gary's firm was on the original brief in the Supreme Court, as I recall, right? You did an amicus brief,
we,
right,
we wrote Gary? The amicus brief for the retired military officers.
Right. And so you've been with us for a long time. Then we got a lot of lawyers going to Guantanamo. We've gotten, a lot of judges, a lot of good rulings. We have a case in the circuit now on whether due process applies. Why now? Why all of a sudden do we see Graham come up with this? Administration on his own? Who did it?
It's hard to say. I mean, there are some people who've surmised or speculated that it might have been related to the Supreme Court granting cert in the Hamden case, which is the military commission case. It's difficult to answer, you know, why he was motivated to do this now. He may really believe some of what he said on the floor, to the effect that this litigation is about it's frivolous petitions, frivolous motions, you know, about whether detainees, you know, what the conditions are that they'll be living under. You know, it's obviously not about that. It's about the fundamental issue of whether or not they should or should not be detained, whether they are or are not enemy combatants.
You should mention that. What were some of the arguments he made to try and convince senators?
Well, I mean, the first argument that he made is he continually referred to everyone there as terrorists. And again, that begs the question. None of these people have had any process, and the whole point of this litigation is to get them some process, some day in court, so that a neutral decision maker can assess whether they are or not terrorists or enemy combatants or not, and whether they ought to be held. So that was one myth that he used. And a second one is that the courts in all around the United States are flooded with this litigation. That's also just not true. All of the cases have been consolidated in the District Court for the District of Columbia. They're all being managed by the judges there. These are tiny, really small number of cases given the overall docket in the courts. And really the last major myth that he focused on was that this is all about such frivolous things as, you know, silly do-gooder lawyers trying to get these detainees mail delivery or to get them to be able to watch DVDs or get high-speed internet. And, you know, most of the examples that he cited were just totally taken out of context, or all of them were. And, I mean, for example, you know, yes, there have been motions filed in these cases by lawyers representing the detainees complaining about the fact that their mail, the letters they send to their clients and the letters their clients send back to counsel, are not being delivered. How can you represent somebody if you can't communicate with them? So it's not that it's not a nicety, it's essential to our representation of the detainees. Similarly, there have been issues about reading materials or the DVDs. In some instances, most of these people have been locked up for 3 or 4 years. They haven't had any communication with their family, and there were a couple of instances where lawyers sought to get permission from the government to provide the detainees DVDs that showed, you know, their family members. You know, in some instances, detainees haven't seen their own children who were born after they were taken into custody. And so this seems like a humanitarian thing to give people an opportunity to see greetings from their family members. It's not pernicious. It's not frivolous. And it really shouldn't be a big issue. But again, the main issue, and it was really that's a phony issue, because the main purpose of the litigation is obviously challenging the detention itself, and it's not about these conditions.
Gary, what are your thoughts on the hunger strike that is presently going on now amongst these people, probably some of your clients?
Well, I think, people are desperate. They've been locked up there for 3 or 4 years, and they see no way out. And that's the only way that they can see to protest their conditions and their detention and try to get some kind of hearing so they can challenge their detention. It's terrible to read about the effect that it's having on people.
What do you think about the government force-feeding these people?
You know, none of us wants any of these people to die. But, you know, there are, as I understand it, there are kind of medical, ethical rules that are in place. And generally, doctors who are going to participate in that kind of force feeding are supposed to consult with family members and others to, and with the person to try to do what's best for the patient. And no one's consulted with anybody here. I mean, that this is, again, where the government is and the people who are working for the military, the doctors and all, they're not following the rules that have been adopted by medical bodies and used in other contexts.
I read that under international law, force feeding someone who's on hunger strike for political reasons can be classified as torture.
I don't know that for fact.
No, I was surprised to read it.
Yeah, it surprises me.
Interesting.
I do know that in the case of Bobby Sands, you know, the Irish hunger striker,
yep,
they actually, and it's a point that Gary's making, is they had his family surrounding him during the entire period, and or at least a lot of the period, and he got to consult and talk to his family, and his family actually in the end signed off on having him not force-fed or not force-fed, because
right,
they understood that was his real political position. And at that point, I think that is the medical ethics right now, of having the family there and letting them consult and figure it out.
My understanding is that is in the ethical rules of the International Medical Association, or I think that's what the international analog of the American Medical Association is called, that in their rules it provides for that, exactly what you described, Michael.
And, of course, they're being force-fed with these tubes, and some of the tubes that get stuffed down people's noses are considered, at least some of our people think they're too wide, or they're too big or too large.
There's certainly been allegations that there have been unnecessary force used in doing this, that they've been using tubes that are not, they're actually reusing tubes from one detainee to another. Now, the government denies that, but, you know, detainees have said they're not sterilizing them. They're not using new tubes, and some of them are wide and more invasive than they need to be. So there certainly are quite a few allegations about even, if you want to call it, abuse of the force-feeding process.
Gary, just one question. Do you think that Senator John McCain will support a compromise of any sort?
Well, we hope ultimately that Senator McCain will support stripping or stripping out of any legislation the provision to strip the courts of jurisdiction, and that he certainly would oppose any provision to deprive the courts of jurisdiction in the pending cases, because from where we sit, we respect the fact that he's been outspoken and a leader on the issue of opposing torture and pushing for the McCain Amendment, but that the bill that's there now, if it read a particular way, could essentially make the McCain Amendment irrelevant, because you can outlaw torture all you want if you don't have habeas rights and you don't have lawyers with an opportunity to talk to the detainees, and you basically are going to bury the detainees in a black hole, then no one's going to ever know if they're being tortured or abused. And so the all of the benefits of the McCain Amendment would be illusory.
Let me ask a last question, Gary, and that is, what do you suggest people do? I mean, should they contact Senator Warner of the Senate? Should they go back to Senator Graham or Levin? What do they do?
I think I would urge people to contact all of their senators and representatives and say, we're opposed to depriving the courts of jurisdiction. Everybody is entitled to their day in court. I would not take anyone for granted in the Senate or the House. They're all important, and in particular, yes, Senator McCain, Senator Graham, they both have, we believe, certainly McCain has been written about national political aspirations, so even people in New York might have an influence with Senator McCain, but basically McCain, Graham, Warner, and I think it's important also to communicate with the Democratic leadership, again, so that they understand that this is an issue that people feel very, very strongly about.
Gary, again, thank you from all of us for being with us, and keep up the great work.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks
Bye,
for
Gary.
Being on Law and Disorder.
For more information, listeners can go to ccr-ny.org or aclu.org. We have a legislative office in Washington, D.C. that's done analysis on the legislation, and there are action alerts on both websites that you can take action on this.
Farewell, Angelina, the bells of the crown. I've been stolen by bandits, I must follow the sound. The triangle tingles, the music plays slow. But farewell, Angelina, the night is on fire and I must go. There is no use in talking, there is no need for blame. There is nothing to prove, everything still is the same. A table stands empty by the edge of the stream. But farewell, Angelina, the sky's changing colors and I must leave.
In legal papers filed late last week by the American Civil Liberties Union, 45 men and women formerly detained at the Orleans Parish Prison recount disturbing details of being abandoned without food or water and abused by guards after Hurricane Katrina struck. The ACLU said that the scores of testimonials it has obtained from prisoners contradict public statements made by Sheriff Marlon Gusman that the prisoners had food and water and that the evacuation went as planned. Eric Balaban, staff counsel of the National Prison Project for the ACLU, is representing all the prisoners in the Orleans Parish Prison. Welcome, Eric, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
What happened to the prisoners who were left behind?
Well, from the accounts we've gotten from prisoners, from the news accounts, from deputies that we've been able to piece together, the prisoners were abandoned at the jail. Deputies turned in their badges wholesale and left their posts. The few deputies who remained at the jail tried to maintain order by using beanbags, shotguns, tasers, and they locked the prisoners down inside the building as the waters began to rise inside the jail.
This is the Orleans Parish Prison?
Yes, it is. The Orleans Parish Prison. It's the ninth largest jail in the country.
And how many inmates were there when this happened?
Approximately 6,600 prisoners.
Wow. They abandoned 6,600 prisoners to the fate of the flood.
Yes, they did.
And these people were locked down?
Most of them were. Some prisoners were able, when the power went out, the generators failed in the jail, some prisoners were able to pop open their cell doors, break through the security barriers into the control cages that officers use to control opening and closing of cell doors, and were able to pop open locks. So many prisoners were able to escape out of their cells.
Do we know how many prisoners were injured or killed as a consequence of that?
We do not know. The Louisiana affiliate of the ACLU filed public records requests under state law to everyone from the governor down to the coroner for New Orleans. There are no confirmed deaths based upon the responses we've gotten to those requests. The sheriff has indicated that no one has died. But deputies have stated that they believed prisoners have died. The prisoners who gave us testimonials state they believe prisoners have died. We just don't have a firm idea whether all the prisoners made it out of the jail safely.
Well, how would they have been able to make it out of the jail if they were, well, most of them presumably were still locked in their cells, but the ones who escaped?
Well, some prisoners were able to escape out of the jail. Some of the accounts that we received, that as the waters began to rise in the jail, rising to a height of up to 10 feet, the prisoners were moved after a day or so to higher floors in the jail by deputies and then left in those higher floors, and prisoners carved their way out through jail cell walls. They broke open their windows. Some of them jumped from these windows and swam themselves to safety. Some turned themselves in after escaping. That's the information that we have.
On the ACLU website, ACLU.org, there are testimonials that are posted, testimonials from people who were in the prison. And according to some of them, they said that prisoners were shot at and some of the prisoners who were attempting to escape rising water inside the jail saw other prisoners being shot in the back.
We're not sure. We do know that, according to deputy accounts, they were firing beanbags at the prisoners. And again, we haven't gotten a full accounting of deaths and injuries from the sheriff.
What are you trying to accomplish now in terms of holding accountable these criminals who abandon these kind of helpless people, and also in terms of publicity? What's happening right now, and what are you trying to get at?
Well, I do want to make clear that the deputies who remained on their posts were abandoned as well. The information that we have is that there was no evacuation plan of which the deputies and line staff were aware. We're gathering this information as part of a long-standing lawsuit called Hamilton. I'm the lawyer for the prisoners in that case.
What's that case about?
That is a long-standing class action lawsuit that addresses virtually every area of operations and conditions at the Orleans Parish Prison. And there have been a series of judgments and decrees that court has entered that require the sheriff to improve services at the jail. One of the decrees, an environmental decree, required the sheriff to institute an evacuation plan for the jail.
So is it correct to say that the correctional officers who left were not formally penalized by the Department of Corrections?
Well, no. I mean,
there
hasn't been any kind of investigation. City Council, the city owns the OPP buildings and has the authority to exert some control over how prisoners are treated at their jail. They haven't held any hearings. No one's called the sheriff to account for what happened at that jail. And again, I do want to emphasize that the deputies who remained there in many cases were heroic because they certainly had not been trained in an evacuation plan. They didn't have the equipment and personnel to effectuate an evacuation. It was only when the line deputies and the line supervisors at the jail went over the head of the sheriff directly to the attorney general of the state, a gentleman named Foti, who used to be the sheriff for New Orleans, that finally they got some help and the evacuation began in earnest. But again,
were these people who had been convicted or who were waiting trial or what?
Most of them are pretrial detainees. There
so
are
a lot
some,
of them.
There are some municipal offenders who are just serving the remainder of their time.
So it's really small time stuff, right?
For the majority of them, that's correct.
Right. Yes. Now let me ask: were there damage cases at all filed, or is your case is really primarily injunctive relief?
Our case is just an injunctive case.
Right. Have there been any damage cases filed on behalf of any of the prisoners?
To my knowledge, so far there haven't been any injunctive cases. One thing to understand, and this is in the testimonials given by the prisoners, the chaos and the horror really didn't start once they were able to escape the jail. They were taken to an overpass on Interstate 10 in the broiling sun. They still hadn't been given any food and water. They didn't have food and water for up to 5 or 6 days.
Really?
Prisoners were fainting. They were passing out. Some were having seizures. Prisoners on the overpass have stated in the testimonials that if they got up and tried to stretch their legs, they were ordered to sit on the pavement. They were maced. If they asked for food and water, they might be maced. Other prisoners were bitten by dogs. Once they got off the overpass, they were taken by bus and by boat to a correctional facility called the Hunt Correctional Facility, which is a state prison in Louisiana. And they were put on a football field and, again, essentially abandoned by guards. And there were a series of prisoner assaults and stabbings on that football field where they remained for up to 3 days.
Are these all men? Was it mixed gender?
Well, it was certainly, you know, in the chaos after the hurricane, it was mixed on the overpass. I don't believe it was mixed at the Hunt facility. Almost all of the women ended up at the Angola State Prison. They actually took over, which is a male prison known as the farm, and they took over one unit that was designed, I believe, for 200 prisoners, and they had close to 500 women in.
Have there been much news about this? Any news articles in New Orleans or anything like that?
There was a very good piece in the New Orleans Times-Picayune by a reporter named Mike Pearlstein, maybe two or three weeks after the hurricane, describing in some detail the conditions inside of the jail, relying very strongly upon accounts that the author had received from deputies and from line staff.
I want to remind our listeners, this is Law and Disorder, WBAI, and we're talking with Eric Balaban. Eric, one last question. How do you account for this extraordinary cruelty that was displayed by the state against these men and women?
Well, I don't quite know how to account for it. You know, I've been doing this work now for 11 years, and it tends not to be pure evil, but more the banality of evil, just an indifference to circumstances and conditions. And I think here the sheriff apparently really failed in his responsibility to keep these men and women safe and was not prepared for this extraordinary event.
And you can see that in the testimonies online at ACLU.org. In one of the testimonies, an inmate says that she was housed in a dorm with 100 other women because of the flooding. The women were left with nothing to eat or drink, and many of them drank water out of trash cans. She says, "I still have recurring nightmares about what I saw and what I went through." Another man said he and other prisoners saw a few dead bodies, and we were told not to say anything or we were going to be like them. He said that when he was evacuated from the building, the water was so high that prisoners had to swim or wade out to safety. And as you were saying, he eventually reached the Interstate 10 overpass, where he was denied food and water for 2 days. What are some of the worst things that you have read about in the testimonials?
Well, you know, among the worst, we've been filing papers in this case, you know, essentially since the hurricane occurred, and there are a couple of very specific testimonials in the form of declarations filed by two prisoners that are available on our website. One prisoner's name, Raphael Schwartz, he was eventually taken out of his cell, was on a first floor, put into a second floor cell, a cell designed for two prisoners with six other prisoners. So he had seven prisoners in a cell. When officers came back to pull out prisoners who had broken out of their cells and to take them out of the building, They didn't take Mr. Schwartz and his six cellmates out when one cellmate began kicking on the cell door. The officers came up and maced the entire cell. Those prisoners were left without food, water, ventilation. They broke out the window in their cell and began waving their tank tops, their orange prison tops, in order to try to signal to someone that they were still alive and still in the facility. And they spent over a day trying to carve the window out of their cell to try to climb to safety. Eventually, when a female officer came in to inspect the premises, she told these men, who she was able to get out of the cell, that she had seen dead bodies in this particular jail, and that she had been told by officers that the unit in prison was clean, that there were no prisoners in there, and she'd only come in after she saw a prisoner jump from this building to another building, breaking his ankles. This is not an atypical situation or a circumstance. And these same stories are repeated over and over and over again. These prisoners went through their own version, you know, of hell, as did all the citizens of New Orleans. And we'd encourage everyone to take a look at the testimonials online and to the summaries of the testimonials, and more will be put up in the coming days and weeks.
At ACLU.org, Eric Balaban of the ACLU's National Prison Project, thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder, and we'll be following your case.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric.
Bye.
Just after the first invasion of Iraq in 1990, the UN Security Council imposed comprehensive economic sanctions that devastated the country. Recently, the sanctions were lifted, but while the sanctions were imposed, many people tried to help the poor and the suffering and the dying in Iraq. One of those has recently been sentenced to 22 years in prison. In Syracuse, New York, a prominent Iraqi-American doctor was just sentenced to over two decades in prison last Thursday for violating the Iraqi sanctions through his charity, Help the Needy. Oncologist Rafil Dafir was arrested 19 months ago in a dramatic fashion. More than 85 federal agents descended on his home. He was handcuffed in his driveway, and agents hauled out dozens of books and records. In August of 2004, New York Governor George Pataki claimed Dafir was connected to money laundering efforts to help terrorist organizations. But terrorism charges against the doctor never materialized. Instead, supporters of the doctor claim the Justice Department went hunting for possible charges against Dr. Dafir. Eventually, they filed 60 charges against him involving breaking the sanctions, tax evasion, and Medicare fraud. Earlier this year, a jury convicted him on 59 of the 60 charges. Joining us today is Barry Gawanter, executive director of the Central New York chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union. She has closely monitored the case and has publicly questioned whether Dr. Dafir received a fair trial. Welcome, Barry, to Law and Disorder.
Hello there.
Barry, why should we care about what happened to Dr. Dafir?
Well, the federal government repeatedly tried to pitch this as a case with national security implications, but they never actually proved a link to terrorism. Instead, this was essentially a white-collar crime case filled with financial statements and financial details, and yet the government really pursued this as if there was much more to the case. The convictions and the sentence that were issued went way beyond what is normally seen in a white-collar case.
What kind of white-collar crime?
Well, fraud cases or money laundering or wire fraud or mail fraud, those were some of the charges in the case. But the way that the prosecution handled this case went way beyond what was usually seen in these kinds of cases.
Barry, we saw here in New York with the prosecution of Lynn Stewart that the tactics of the government were very unfair in two respects. One, they totally overcharged her, and they scared the pants off the jury with all this terrorism stuff, you know, like showing videos of Osama bin Laden on the wall. Did anything like that happen up there?
Well, it was interesting because certainly there were 60 charges, and it does seem like perhaps there was overcharging. There was also the issue of criminal charges being given in situations where otherwise fines might be imposed and criminal charges would not be necessary. Additionally, the prosecution insisted throughout the trial that terrorism or a terrorist link or a terrorism investigation should not be mentioned. And they kept on to that with a series of objections. And yet, after the conviction, when they submitted their sentencing memo, they then brought in through the back door allegations of terrorist links.
Yeah, that's the stuff they dropped at the very beginning with this case. I mean, they couldn't charge him as a terrorist. So then they come up with other charges, and they then try to insinuate that he's a terrorist. Put him away. We're not going to charge him with crimes of terrorism, but put him away because he is a terrorist.
Well, the reality is they found no actual links to any terrorist groups. There was really very little dispute that the charity that he ran was created for humanitarian purposes, and yet having invested all this money and time in the investigation over the course of years, they still wanted to get a conviction.
This man is giving real aid to people who are dying in Iraq because of the sanctions, and he's being put away for over two decades for it.
There was evidence in the case that there was humanitarian aid that did end up in Iraq, but I have to say very clearly that the doctor did make mistakes in the way that he ran the charity. Certainly mistakes were made.
Mistakes that would justify putting him in prison for 20 years?
I feel that the sentence is way beyond what was appropriate in this case.
You know, I have to say, Barry, I'm not unsympathetic with the doctor trying to help people in Iraq. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright at the time told Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes on CBS, on American TV. Stahl asked her, isn't it true that 600,000 children in Iraq died as a result of the sanctions? Is it worth it? Secretary Albright thought about it for a second and said, yes, it's worth it.
The collateral damage argument. But, you know, there's a lot of people in the States who feel like, who felt like it's not worth it, and that because we're Americans, we have to stand up to the U.S. government, and that we would need to directly help individuals in Iraq who are suffering because of our U.S. sanctions.
The ACLU really takes no position on the war in Iraq per se, but when you look at the operation of this charity, normally in New York State, a charity that had problems of commingling charitable and personal funds would simply be shut down by the Attorney General's office. Fines would be imposed, and there may be state charges, but not federal charges.
The other thing that seemed fishy to me about this is you look at other groups like the group Voices for the Wilderness, who and that group provided direct aid for Iraqis, and I believe in the form of medical assistance. And they got slapped just this past summer with a $20,000 fine. I mean, a $20,000 fine, that's it. Not saying that was deserved, but it's not comparable to 22 years in prison.
Certainly it's not. And one of the core charges against the doctor is that he violated a law referred to as IEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which is used to impose sanctions on countries that are thought to pose a threat to the United States. But under IEPA, the government can either file criminal charges or impose a fine. And yet it seems as if the only people that get fined, that get criminal charges against them, seem to be of Muslim and Arab descent.
We're seeing first Muslims who contribute through charitable organizations getting slapped. And now the next step is this week I heard about Iraqi Kurds in the state of Virginia who are giving money back home to their families. They're sending money back home, and now they're being charged with violating the sanctions. I mean, this isn't money that's being sent for any unlawful purpose. It's money, it's chump change, really, going from poor people to even poorer people.
Well, there also seems to be a real sort of double standard. There are American companies such as ESPN and Royal Crown Cola and several other companies that did business with Iraq.
Did they?
During the time the sanctions were in place, and no CEO was brought up on criminal charges.
Was who?
I believe it was Royal Crown Cola and ESPN, and there was a couple of other American companies that also did business with Iraq and had fines imposed on them. but no criminal charges.
Do you know how large the fines were?
I'm not sure how large the fines were, but looking at the group Voices in the Wilderness, they clearly and openly and defiantly violated the sanctions, and yet all they receive is a fine. This seems to be a clear double standard in collective enforcement.
We're talking to Barry Gewanter, who's the head of the Central New York chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union up in Syracuse, talking about the 20-year sentence imposed on Dr. Dafir for allegedly giving money to people in Iraq. One last thing, Barry. Can you tell us if people want to support this case, get more information on it? Is there a contact?
Well, there is. There's a website that you can go to that has actually been done by one of the observers of the trial, and that's www.dafirtrial.org.
Can you give that to us once again for our listeners, Barry?
Sure. It's Dafir Trial, D-H-A-F-I-E-I-R, trial, one word, .org. And on there, you'll learn about the defense fund. You can also contact the Islamic Society of Central New York, which is the mosque here in Syracuse, and ask them how you might be able to support the Muslim community here, who has also been terrorized by the prosecution's tactics in this case.
Barry Gewanter of the New York Civil Liberties Union, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Barry.
A couple of issues that we reported on in the past, intelligent design and CFC, the combined federal campaign, had a couple of victories last week. It's good to see some victories in these depressing days. In Dover, they had a school board election, and all eight school board members who voted for intelligent design in the schools, which is basically creationism, they were voted out. It's a clear sign from Dover residents that they do not want their school board forcing religions back into the schools.
A particular kind of religion.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I always thought about this a lot. I think I'd be in favor of it if they called it dumb design. I mean, I would believe that there's a God then and it's dumb design, because this is the dumbest set of people I've ever seen in this world, and particularly in the administration.
Well, you know, I don't think it doesn't. Intelligent design, if you want to believe intelligent design or if you want to believe in creationism, that's fine. But that's definitely a religious belief.
No, I don't mind the religious belief. I mind that they call it intelligent.
Yeah.
You should call it unintelligent. And besides that.
If you go to lawanddisorder.org, you can listen to our interview with Vic Walsat from the ACLU of Pennsylvania. The lawyer in the case suing the Dover School Board and representing the parents who don't want Christian religion taught in their schools.
A particular kind of Christian religion. Don't slander all the Christians.
There's a narrow group of morons. Well, you can. I have great respect for the Christian religion. Just don't teach it in schools. Don't teach any religion in school. And another note, combined federal campaign. Most people probably don't know about this. Basically, the government has a combined federal campaign, a charity campaign type thing, where they allow federal employees to make a donation from their paychecks to a charity. And thousands of charities are on this list. While the government required, they were saying the government required that all the participating charities had to check the names of their employees against terrorist watch lists to make sure that their employees were not terrorists. And 12 nonprofits are challenging that. And last week, there was what some people have called a major victory, in that the combined federal campaign will no longer have the requirement that participating charities check the names of their employees on government terror watch lists.
That was a case brought by, among the 12, the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights,
which were really concerned
over having to check their watch lists.
Yeah, Amnesty International, NAACP, Natural Resources Defense Council, all great charities that don't want to be investigating their employees.
Chalk one up for us.
Two. Yeah, and then with the Patriot Act, the Graham Amendment, and Cheney lobbying against the McCain Amendment. I think we're still in the red.
Well, I think we're in the 14th round, and we're losing.
So we see the administration is unraveling, but as they unravel, they still seem to have some power to harm us significantly, and they have three more years in there.
So, Michael, you still think we got them on the run?
I think we got them on the run, but people on the run are dangerous. They're more like cornered dogs with very vicious teeth.
Hey, don't slander the dogs.
And if you have comments, please go to lawanddisorder.org. We really love hearing from you. So give us your comments, your feedback, your suggestion, and you can listen to past segments that you've missed.
A reminder to all our listeners, Law and Disorder is now going to be on weekly, 99.5, every Monday, 10 o'clock after Amy. And if anybody out there in radio land wants to watch me, Michael Smith, on television this coming Tuesday, November 22nd at 10:30 on Channel 34, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, I'll be on the Harold Channing Show.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Everything is all right. Everything is all wrong. Everything is all right. Everything is all wrong. Nobody likes making things go wrong. And not one thing they start, they show mistake. A mistake they start, they show mistake. Mistake they make two kinds. One kind they call them good mistake. The other kind they call them bad mistake. Good mistake you fit repair. Bad mistake they cause disgrace. Mistake you go make, people go laugh at you. Mistake you go make, you fit stand like a man. Mistake you go make, people fit laugh at you. After they laugh at you, them go smile again. Mistake you go make, your mind go clear like rain. After all the mistake, you still stand like a man. That means say everything is alright. That means say you are right, everything is all. That means say
everything's
all right. You are right,
everything's
all right. That means say
everything's
all right. You are right,
everything's
all right. La 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 la. But mistake you go make, people go laugh at you. Mistake you go make, people go laugh at you. After they laugh at you, them keeps laughing at you. Mistake you go make, you go beg some man. You dey beg the man because you fear the man. Mistake you go make, you go shame to walk for road. Mistake you go make, you no go fit stand like a man. Last day you are black, you know they think like black. That means say everything is all wrong. That means say you are wrong. That means say you are wrong. Now bad mistake. Colonial thinking, slavery thinking. I mean killing students, soldiers they for school. Now bad mistake. Bad mistake, now bad mistake. Colonial thinking, slavery thinking. I'm mean killing students, so not for school. I'm mean burning houses, now bad mistake.